Hi, I'm Emma Cousin, an artist in South East London, and I started this podcast to keep us artists in touch under lockdown. And now, as we come out of it and we enter these various strange new normals, I wanted to talk to other artists about the impact on the artistic community, to explore what might have changed, what's been lost, and what might have been discovered. After a little break, I'm delighted to launch this episode, number 25, with Hans Op de Beek. Hans Op de Beek and I talk about it being excited to be back at work, and he describes his time away from his studio as numb. We talk about the joys of painting in the dark, the intimacy and generosity of the night. Hans talks about wanting to paint in colour, telling a story of making a painting for the Royal Palace in Brussels, which in the end was in black and white. Hans talks about exploring the width of being a most postmodern artist, which he thinks is about balancing form and content precisely. He talks about people overestimating him and the idea of faking it till you make it. He talks about jumping into problems and getting out of your comfort zones as essential positions for making work. We talk about art as consolation and the idea of finding comfort in a visual proposal. We discuss his work Stargazing 2020, visually climbing the cliff through his descriptions. He talks about being anachronistic with ironic winks, mingling bad and good taste and high and low culture. And we talk about art, art's historical eye-openers, and how something can be artificial and also authentic. We talk about departing from the simple and getting complicated and evoking rather than stimulated. We talk quite a lot about the colour grey. We talk about staging amusement and staging emotions and celebrate the beauty in the silliness of life. Thank you for joining us for Chats with Artists Under Lockdown. Hello, Hans Op de Beek.
Oh, now you sound different.
Oh, do I? Oh. How are you?
I'm kind of relieved that I'm back at work at the studio after months of strangeness and unusual situations. And so just happy to be here with my team fully working again and being productive and having some sort of a schedule.
Nice. Yeah. And have you not been in the studio over the lockdown or whatever that looked like where you are in Brussels?
There's been a period of about 3 months that I decided to close down the studio, not because there was no work to be done, but just because, of course, I wanted to be socially correct. And I thought, okay, let's then close. And but everybody of my team, as much as myself, we were so happy to be back to some sort of a normal inside of the studio building. So and then, of course, we were confronted with many things that were like Art Basel was not there anymore. And, you know, like art fairs for which we produce things and my solo exhibition with Galleria Continua was all of a sudden an online show, which of course is not a show, especially when you make sculptural work.
Definitely.
That needs to be experienced in the very space. All these things that were cancelled or postponed or that were shifted to sort of online versions, that was just difficult to deal with and to be confronted with. There was a time that I was, like the 3 months that I closed the studio, I was just working by myself, and I thought that it would inspire me and that I that I would be writing a lot more and that I'd be doing like painting big watercolors that I always do by myself. And but all of that just didn't happen. It was somehow numbing this period.
I wondered about that because I've heard you talk about productivity before as well in various interviews and reference this idea of like working all the time sort of as part of a an artist practice, and that's how you've developed your practice, is this idea of, like, we call it graft here in England, but the idea of like working hard or working a lot. And I wondered how you might have adapted, thinking that the obvious thing would be the scale thing, I guess, going down to a smaller watercolour rather than the bigger pieces. But has that gap, in, especially maybe back in the studio now with the support of this, the assistants, has that gap actually provided a good, you know, the space you were hoping for in a way? Because it's like a middle gap.
Well, in fact, I wasn't hoping for anything. But
well, it sounds like maybe, I don't know, what you might have thought it would be.
In the sense that I thought that, I'd have like this time for more profound introspection. And since I started to write theater and all that some years ago, I thought that would deliver me sort of a production time that, like, that demands a sort of isolation and not the busyness of a whole team running around you and asking you questions that you have to guide. And but somehow it just didn't happen.
It's probably worth talking a bit about the team at that point then. So you have 6 assistants full time, is that right? Oh, eight. Amazing. That sounds so stressful to me, but also amazing. I mean, is it both? Is it ever a tension between, obviously you can get more done, but maybe you have to manage people, right?
Yeah, exactly. But I always found a form of consolation and in the fact that I think that I can always quite easily go back to just working by myself. And so this somehow mentally takes away the pressure of a team that you think, well, I have to, you know, when you somehow feel that everything is still not decided somehow when it comes to the next, let's say 20, 25 years, it could evolve in any direction. And that somehow liberates you from what could be a pressure of performing and having things all organized for you and your team. So I don't feel it as a pressure, because I also told them, like, when they started to work for me one by one over the years, like, look, I just want to create a lovely setting and let's do some lovely things together, and but at some point I might have to, you know, to reorganize or to redefine my practice, and that might imply that I have to let go of having a team. And they all agreed on that, on that idea. And look, now people are already, some of my people are already working with me for 14, 15 years. So it didn't come to an end.
No, it's like a family now.
Yes, it's absolutely a second family to me. Yeah.
And I was interested in the architecture of that practically, like the people and the making, and maybe like the practicalities of a studio and where that happens, and then where you as the artist is in that space at various times. You must move through the spaces and have designated sort of activity areas that are non-linear, I guess. And I just wondered if you could just speak about that and how that's evolved, where things happen and why and how in the studio and with these people.
Well, there is, I have Anne, who's my general coordinator of the studio. So she's dealing with all the requests and consignments and contacts with the galleries and all kinds of questions. And then also the whole to-do list for the entire team. So we have a weekly, we sit together with the entire team and go through everything that needs to be done. Mm-hmm. Then I have Tom, who's coordinating production, mainly sculptural production. And there is Nicholas, who is an animation filmmaker, who mainly helps me with a part of the sculptural production, but also with everything that has to do with video and film. I made about 25 videos that are all extremely different when it comes to the format. Some are like medium length, cinematically approached films with a lot of extras in it. Some are digital animation films. Some are analog animation films. So it's all very different. And then aside of those three people that mainly coordinate, I have people working with me on the sculptures. So the sculptural production is the biggest part of what I do, like the large-scale immersive installations that need like a sort of an architectural approach, and then all the sculptural figures and characters that we make, objects, pieces of furniture, scaled down landscapes, all of that. So the biggest part of the team is involved in sculptural production, and then in between all those things, I'm writing and painting watercolor paintings.
I love that. The in-betweens sound really delicious.
Yeah, it's the moments that I'm here by myself in the evenings mainly, or overnight. I used to paint and write quite a lot. Nice. And during the day, there's too many things that are, you know, that are happening parallelly. So
I often thought that about working at night. I used to do the same thing, paint in the evenings. And it was exciting because everyone leaves you alone.
Yeah. Exactly.
So you can tune out and do it. It's like a different version of time somehow, because it's so expansive at nighttime.
Yeah, like normally I used to paint from 8 in the evening until 8 in the morning.
Wow.
Yeah, it's like 12 hours without any interruption. So that's really lovely.
Do you think that's where the because I'm interested, I mean, we're jumping around a bit, but this idea of because I found if I painted at nighttime, the light and the color was very different in the daytime. So especially color. And I've obviously, to some extent, your palette is grayscale or gray. There's a lot of grays. You might disagree completely, but
yeah, I'm just not good enough to paint in colors yet. So I hope at some point I will arrive making a good colorful painting. But so I really long to do that.
Really?
But for the moment, I work in watercolor, and still the paintings are quite large. Eh? They're like 2.5 to 3 meters wide. So it's really like very big frames. And so I stretch very large sheets of watercolor painting. And as you know, the white of the paper in a watercolor is your light source. And so you somehow paint in how can I say that? Like the things that catch light, they are like, they have the least amount of pigment. Mm.
It's a negative positive almost, isn't
it? It's like a negative process, exactly. Yeah. So yeah. It's very delicate, and you have to layer it, and you have to be patient and let the paper dry in between. But it's really about light and how light animates and gives life to a setting, to a fictitious landscape or interior or to a person. Mm. And the concentration is all on that rather than on the use of color.
And do you think that's why watercolor, like, I know you were trained in painting. I don't know if you've painted with other things. I'm assuming you have, because you've done everything else.
Yeah, and I wondered, in prehistoric times, I was painting in color.
Okay, but also with different types of paint, maybe.
Yeah, so I tried so many things, and and then at some point I was commissioned by the royal family here in Belgium, by the king and the queen, to produce an art piece for the royal palace. And I thought, okay, I have to push myself to do something else, something out of my comfort zone. And so I told the queen that I'd be very happy to make a colorful painting for her. And then it took about almost 4 years.
Wow.
And at the end of that, I told her, like, I'm sorry, I really have to, you know, I made three diptychs of black and white watercolor paintings for you.
Amazing. What did she say?
Yeah, she was totally fine with it. In fact, she was not insulted or anything. I said, I just didn't manage. So I was asking for more time to, I said, I only want to, you know, give you something that I'm happy with myself. If not, you know, I will be regretting it for the rest of my life that my work is there at the Royal Palace.
Yeah, definitely.
You know, permanently, and that it's like a dreadful painting. So I told her, like, the best I can do in two dimensions is watercolor on paper. So that's what it finally became.
Nice. Yeah, lucky them. I think it takes me, you mentioned this idea of comfort zones that I've read that you referenced before, and you said pushing yourself.
Exactly.
And I was interested in that idea of how you stretch your art practice. It seems like continually that's one of your, I don't know, your rules for yourself or your kind of gauges, never get too comfy and keep evolving, you know, keep pushing. I wondered how that strategy has developed and how, you know, when that sort of, when you realized that was a marker and how it's developing the work and maybe and how it's developing you as a person, I don't know, to deal with failure and all these other things that come with being an artist and things not going right, or it feels like they're really interesting, important, but quite difficult, maybe, things to see as positives.
Yeah, I think you and I are artists of the postmodern era.
Mm-hmm.
And we've had people before us that were, you know, artists in the modern era that, you know, that could have an oeuvre that was solely about one color or about putting stripes or squares or you know, something very repetitive and it kind of a monk's daily activity to paint the same icon over and over again.
Yep.
So those artistic journeys were quite different, I think, than how we define an artist's practice today. I think we are exploring a bit more in the width than artists used to do, like about 50 years ago or so. Well, of course, I can't generalize, but that's at least a generation I feel like I'm part of, not just medium wise, but also just on the subjects and on the aesthetics. And I think our task as an artist is to balance form and content very precisely, so it becomes content. But the content itself is not that overly important, I would say. It's more about the preciseness and how we balance things. And then you can be very kitsch or baroque or minimal or whatever kind of aesthetic you use or whatever kind of format that you employ. It by itself does not matter that much. It's more about how we manage to bring something to life. And that's what I've always been trying. And then I just ended up doing like a movie with 800 extras or I like years ago, I wrote and directed and did the stage design and costumes for a first theater play in the Schauspiel Frankfurt in Germany.
Mm.
And those things arrived to me of people totally overestimating my capacities. And then I thought, well, let's give it a try. And I truly love this nervosity of being out of the comfort zone, because I think that's the very essence of being a creative person, is not to, you know, to lock yourself up in like a format or in something that feels very comfortable and that you know how to do.
Yeah.
But then all of a sudden I found myself at a table with like eight actors and people that are used to do like very serious repertoire in a very big cities theater, people that do Arthur Miller on Monday and Ionesco on Tuesday, and you know, and then all of a sudden on Wednesday they're rehearsing with you. and so you have to pretend fake it until you make it. You have to do
that's brilliant. Yeah,
yeah, you have to try to be self you have to try to have the confidence to pull it off, and it's an incredible learning process. So I really, when I did that very first play I did, was so adventurous and lovely to explore, And then at some point, the opera world started to discover me, and then they asked me to, like the Opera of Stuttgart, they asked me to direct and do the stage design and costumes for Bluebeard's Castle of Bartok. And I never directed opera singers whatsoever. And I'm not an opera expert whatsoever. So then you have to really jump and know and learn and discover. And that's how I've been broadening my practice in many directions, in this case, towards the performing arts, to theater and opera. And hopefully, of course, it's not infinite. You can't.
Yeah. Well, maybe it's that I'm interested, because I feel like it's, I mean, there's so much to learn. I'm often kind of overwhelmed and excited. And I mean, that's why we're doing this. We're all curious. And it's, there's so much that's possible that we don't know and that we want to try and get into. And I don't know, it's really exciting to sort of hear you speak, not flippantly, but with a kind of lightness about it. It's not a scary endeavor. It's okay not to know what you're doing sometimes, I guess. but I wondered, when that started. Like, have you always been like that as a kid? Did you always have that kind of quiet confidence that you could step into something, or has that developed as you've done more of it?
No, as a kid, I was extremely nerdy, and I was like totally unsportive. Like all the boys were playing football, and I was the nerdy kid that was always inside, indoors, reading comic books. And I was very shy as well. Like if people would give me some attention, my head was like a tomato, you know, like totally shy and blushing all the time. And I was totally not the self-confident kid. It was a long process that before I dared to be confident. Was when I graduated from art school, then all of a sudden I understood that people really appreciated what I did. And only then I felt like, there's a chance I can do something with this, you know. So step by step. But still, today I'm surprised how much confidence people give me.
I like that. They give you confidence rather than you having it naturally.
yeah, exactly.
And then, I wouldn't. Maybe that's a good moment to ask about this idea of mentors. I don't know whether it's a very like 21st century thing, but it feels like that specific word, or it's not at all, it comes round. But right now it seems like a word that lots of young artists are looking for a mentor. And I think that's something that's interesting, when often, and I think you've spoken about this, it doesn't work like that. Somebody sees something in you and then they give you the confidence. You don't go and find someone in that way. So I know you've talked about Michelangelo Pistoletto, and I just wondered if you could talk a little bit about that idea of the mentor and how that specific relationship kind of developed with Pistoletto.
When I was studying at the Rijksacademie in Amsterdam, which is a sort of a postgraduate program for visual artists, Michelangelo Pistoletto was one of my guest professors, and he was one of the first who was so enthusiastic about what I what I did. He said, "Oh, I love your work, and I'm going to show it in Italy," which he did. And it was so amazing to have someone so sincerely and honestly supporting you as a younger colleague. I needed that in a way to believe in myself and to understand that, hey, maybe this is true. Maybe there's something about my work that is okay and that can be shown. And Pistoletto is a totally different type of artist when it comes to his work. It's a different type of work. It's not like that I'm, let's say, that my work is something that has to do with how his work formally looks like, or so it was more like someone that I appreciated as a person and as a sort of an energy force, a super dynamic character. He's a real He has his big foundation in Biella, between Milano and Torino, where he has artist residencies, and he's this kind of pater familias in the art world that wants to promote and help. And it's so admirable, this energy and this attitude. And it's something that I've been teaching in quite some art schools over the past decades, and I also try to have this constructive attitude and really trying to think along and to assimilate with what the very student is doing, and try to think along and also put things in perspective, telling them that I'm just one opinion, that I don't have the truth in my hands about what is good or bad, but just, you know, being someone that can encourage someone's brave decision to becoming an artist.
Interesting. I mean, I think it's also brave because particularly maybe what you're saying about putting yourself in this uncomfortable place, that you're putting yourself in a place also where you're doing everything. Okay, you have some assistants, but you're doing everything, as in you're making, say, with the opera, directing, stage design. You know, it's a lot. And I just wondered if that idea of being able to do it then maybe leads to some sense of like a controlling, like where how do you stop yourself becoming controlling over everything? And how, you know, because it feels quite free still, like I say, this lightness you're talking about.
Yeah, I think as visual artists, we are somehow used to take the full-on authorship of what we do. Other than, you know, that people who are trained to be an actor, they are trained to being part of a whole production with so many people involved. And when we make a painting or a sculpture, it's like you decide everything yourself. And so for me, it was somehow self-evident that when I do theater, that I would write the play, that I would direct it, and that I do the set design and the costumes. It is because it's so connected. And it's not because I overestimate my own capacities whatsoever, but it's more like the concern for the coherence of what you do. And when it's very bad, then there is also no one else to blame but yourself. You know, so I like this position that you have the full responsibility, and that it's about learning and trying to overview the whole. It's not so much about control, but it's more about the concern about consistency and coherence.
Yeah, I mean, I've got one quote from you that says you try to construct something like a constellation, and that's taken out of context, I realize. But this idea about making the work that, you know, almost like a proposal that is a constellation. Maybe you meant by that a constellation of life, this idea that we're all going to die. So I don't know, maybe that's a bit heavy. But I wondered if that's something to do with it, this idea of constructing something like a constellation.
It's yeah,
like a get out of jail free card, maybe.
Yeah, it might sound a bit corny, but I do think that when an art piece is something like a consoling hand on your shoulder, that it's really a piece that works. It is because, like, you through identification, when you can identify yourself with a fictitious character, or when you're invited to, you know, to gaze to be immersed into a fictitious landscape, for example, there is a feeling of consolation or tranquility or peacefulness that you might find, even when the landscape or the character is not like a happy, joyful view or persona. It is like when you identify with, let's say, the protagonist of a Greek tragedy, you understand, like, hey, this man or woman is like going through the same difficulties and clumsiness that I'm confronted with. And it's just consoling to understand that you're not alone in this. And I don't even consider it like something very heavy or charged, but just like a very human reaction that you can find consolation or comfort in a visual proposal by an artist that delivers something like a good, profound feeling.
Yeah, No, I think that is really interesting, and it's also interesting that it highlights maybe my Britishness in calling it heavy. You know, we don't talk about existentialism. Maybe that's quite funny. It makes me think particularly of the piece Stargazing, and I realize this is a podcast, so it's hard to talk about visual pieces without describing them, but maybe I'll put that over to you to describe a little bit the sculpture called Stargazing, made in 2020. I just wonder if you could speak about that piece a little bit in this, through what we're talking about, this idea of constellation, and I wondered if that piece is positioned in a near past or a near future, and this idea of like utopia or alternatives maybe being suggested in some of the work or not.
So the piece is like a very big rock. It's a piece on scale, so it's like a model, and there's a small jetty with a rowing boat and a sort of sculpted water surface below, and then you can visually climb up the cliff through a lot of a succession of scaffolding and bridges and stairs and then on the top of the rock there is this tree with a treehouse, and of course from there you have this overly romantic view on what we presume is an incredible landscape, but we don't see the landscape. We only see like this little romantic spot. And what I love to do in my work is to mingle, to be very anachronistic. Like, for example, I made a very large scale installation, which is called the Collector's House. And it looks a bit like a petrified space. It's like 250 square meters. It's like a very large museum space by itself. And you can walk through it, but it's like you have a sculpted Chesterfield couch or a representation of a 1950s sculpture. As a sort of an ironic wink, but you'd also find like sculpted pizza boxes and sculpted laptops or cell phones. So it's like totally anachronistic. It looks a bit like a neoclassical space, but it contains things from now, from nowadays, but also from the past. And I always try to mingle a good taste, bad taste, high and low culture into a sort of a mix that altogether delivers something like a universal archetype or something that is timeless. Mm. Like, for example, in Japan, I have a permanent installation, which is a motorway restaurant in which you can sit down. And when you look through the window, you look out on a very monumental sculpture of a nocturnal motorway. A rocky landscape, and then there is this motorway, which is a trompe-l'oeil, a sculpture of a road that is constructed in a slant and that narrows down towards the horizon. But you have the impression like it's an infinite nocturnal landscape, and it is very, let's say, nowadays to show a no man's land as we know it when we're on the road, and we have to tank. We have to fill the car with gasoline, and then we have a coffee, and we somehow dissolve in this kind of modern or postmodern setting. I think this type of installation really talks about the timelessness that one also could find 200 years ago. Mm. So it's not so much about the very aesthetics of contemporary architecture or neoclassical or classical architecture. It's more like about the blend or the mixture that I try to balance out to the point that it becomes immersive, that it becomes like a sort of timeless space or zone that you can dissolve into as a spectator.
Mm. Yeah, that is interesting, especially thinking about the painting and watercolor particularly, but the idea of your references as a painter, because even those constructions have some kind of vignettes or sensibilities of Mirandi, like the Still Life series, for instance. Or I was thinking particularly about Hammershøi, Wilhelm Hammershøi, and I'm sure you have your own references. I just wondered if you could talk about those kind of painterly influences or famous windows, if you like, in paintings through history that might have influenced that kind of aesthetic or that view or that
Yeah, absolutely. I do love the art historical not examples, but like eye openers.
Yeah.
Like for example, in the early Renaissance, when you had in the Low Countries, you had for example, a Flemish painter was called Patinir, and Patinir was one of the first painters that painted the landscape as a genre by itself, because before him, landscape was just something to fill up the backdrop. So it was not something by itself. And then it somehow became a genre by itself. And those landscapes, they had a very strong sensation of depth. Like you'd see, like in the foreground, things would be brownish or greenish, and the more you visually go to the next plan, it would become more and more bluish, and so there was a strong sense of creating an infinite view or something like a depth, For example, the rocky parts were painted in a very naive way, simply because at that time it was not that easy to travel to Switzerland or Italy to go and see the real mountains. So in a very naive way, you see Patinir doing his best to paint something like a mountain, but it looks like an oversized cobblestone or something like that. So, so there's a sort of naivety in the way these constructions were made. But what I learned from it is that despite the fact that something can be like totally artificial, it can become credible as an experience. It is like, for example, when you read a novel, at some point you forget you're holding a book in your hands. And that very point, you know, is really so important, that despite the fact that at all times you realize it's just something, some words and lines and some narration that's made up by someone, all of a sudden you're living it. And I can be as moved by a character in a novel as I can be moved by my own kids, you know? So it is as authentic as an experience. And to understand this on the level of, let's say, visual arts or movie making or whatever, It's so liberating that you know that you don't have to hide the construction. If you openly show this is just a construction, then it's not an issue anymore. And from there on, you can move on with your spectator and invite him or her to, you know, to identify with the construction and to find an authentic experience in it.
Definitely. Yeah, and it's interesting to think about, you referenced as a kid being the geek who was reading the comic books, you know, that idea of lost in a world that, especially comics, I think have that fantastic ability to simplify and exaggerate human experience to make it very immediate and kind of personal in a way, which seems strange. I wondered in that vein, if there is like a lowbrow, you talked about kitsch things being as interesting, is there something that's maybe particularly at the moment or maybe more in general that's more kitsch that you're attracted to or that you collect and it's become part of the work or that you look at for inspiration that maybe is less expected than a Flemish painter?
Well, it's more about understanding the value of things that are not let's say artistically correct. For example, when I'm sitting in a shopping mall with my mom having a cup of coffee, of course the whole setting is very kitschy. We'd be sitting like in a bar that has this kind of furniture that is a fake Art Deco furniture with a totally over the top kind of nostalgic interpretations of what once was a style. Yet, you know, when you sit like in a perfect architecture, like artistically correct architecture, of course you can admire the aesthetics and the sublime of a very strong and good architect. But when you see it in, I mean, I would say in Belgium, like 99% of the architecture you see is like bad taste or is. And so the very thing that speaks about life as it is, it's not the good taste, but it's rather the bad taste. So when you include like clumsy, inept style elements or wrong taste details, you might speak more about life as it is than when you make art that looks like perfectly stylish and like the perfect minimalist object or something like that. So coming from a comic book background, I very fastly understood, like, if you talk about life, you also talk about the inept, the awkward, the clumsy aspects of life.
Yeah, I mean, it's making me think of the Wunderkammers particularly. Not just the ones you made, but this idea of a Wunderkammer, because it's they're kind of gross, you know, they're a cacophony of stuff that's put together to be wondered at, you know, and sometimes they're individually wonderful, but actually more often than not, they're kind of the grotesque or weird or not that interesting individually. It's the cacophony that makes it spectacular or something. So I'm thinking about those, and particularly the ones that obviously your Wunderkammers, and they seem to me that as a kind of metaphor, this idea of zooming in and zooming out, it seems to speak to this attention shift that you're sort of talking about, even in the shopping mall, that you're having a cup of coffee, but that you're thinking about the bench you're sitting on and you're zooming out to the lights and then, you know, all these kind of details, as well as the big picture and the kind of mood or the atmosphere of the spaces. I just wondered if you could talk about this attention shift in the work and how maybe you're able to affect it, and maybe any specific, I don't know, whether they're tricks, traits, you know, kind of devices that you think that you've thought about to try and play with that shift. I mean, scale being the obvious one that you work on. Watercolors then 600-meter-squared installations, which is bonkers, you know. But if there are more subtle things, maybe, because I'm sure it's very complicated, that shifting in and out. It's quite a big question, probably.
Yeah, it's quite a question. Yeah, it's of course, I think at some point you do a lot on intuition. It's I love to depart from something that seems to be very simple and then necessarily becomes highly complicated when it comes to defining all the details and all the things that make it work or not. For example, recently I made a horseman. So I departed from the very simple idea of let's try and sculpt a horse. Then I thought there should be someone on the horse. Okay, so a horseman. And then you think, but what kind of horseman is it? Is it like a prestigious historical figure? Or is it, what kind of man or woman could this be? And then I thought it should be like a postmodern or contemporary refugee-like, enigmatic person on the road, someone with like a contemporary Don Quixote or something like that. Mm-mm. And that, but how could he look like? And well, he's wearing jeans and he's not wearing a shirt or anything, but there is a little monkey on his shoulder holding a small parasol. And just step by step, I start to define and smuggle in all kinds of references that I think that make the whole work. But it's not so overly conscious. It's always by free association that I try to compose and bring things together that at some point to me feel like now there's something appearing, now there's something that starts to work. And if it works for me as the first spectator, I, of course, by extension, I hope it also works for other people. But that's a very subjective and intuitive process, I would say, rather than a very, very conscious strategy. But it's indeed like you have the outsider's view of the reflective person that takes some distance on one hand. But on the other hand, there's also you trying to create something that you bring to the point that for you yourself as a first spectator, it becomes immersive or it becomes an experience. like a physical and mental experience.
Yeah, I mean, I think I'm interested if that this idea of starting with something simple and then it becoming complicated and then bring it back to something simple almost is kind of concertina. Maybe the, I mean, I'm going back to grey again, this obsession with colour. But this idea of the grey being the way to get rid of a lot of things as well, in a way, it's like a becomes a language when you use it in the way you do about shadows and silence and you know, kind of death potentially and isolation and nighttime, and it has a lot of different qualities, I suppose. You know, the idea of the simplification to grey then becomes complicated in a way.
Yeah, but it also has to do with the fact that I'm really interested in evoking something rather than simulating something. So simulation, I think by itself is not not an interesting thing for me. So, for example, if I sculpt a human figure like a man or a woman or a child, and if I would do that like in full color and hyper-realistically, like a Madame Tussauds kind of effort, then I think, why would I bother? It's more interesting that you, well, in my case, because I'm not judging, we have marvelous artists like Ron Newick, for example, who is a hyper-realist. But for me personally, I don't see the value within my process to think about simulation, trying to, for example, the motorway diner I made, the life-size motorway diner I made in Japan, it is totally dark gray. And the only color in the installation is like the orange natrium light as we have it at night on the motorways here in Belgium. So it's really like reducing everything to a sort of an essence rather than trying to painstakingly simulate a real motorway restaurant, which by itself is more like, I would say, a set design for a movie rather than doing something sculpturally or something that really can become something immersive. So, you know, to make sort of an abstraction in reduction of color, reduction of skin, the skin of the very objects that you use. Or when I, for example, use a chair, I would make the chair myself here at the studio and not go and buy a chair in a store, because then this is why I don't use ready-mades and sculptural installations, because I believe that when you give an interpretation of the object, when you represent an object, it is automatically more like an interpretation or something more potentially essential than assembling or putting existing objects together.
That's really interesting. I think it's interesting as well because it calls to attention. You have to learn about how the object's made, right? So it calls to attention sort of how ridiculous it is that we don't know that we can't all make chairs, but we have one to sit on at home, you know?
Yes.
There's something really strange about that disassociation with the craft or with the fabrication or with, you know, that things just appear, especially as makers, I think it's interesting. No, amazing. I mean, also the it kind of makes me think about you were saying how you wanted to make this horse and this idea of what type of horse it would be. I mean, I love that idea that you couldn't really go out and buy the horse. So that's an example of, you know, how ridiculous it is. And then maybe you had to look at some horses, but then you had to look at a fake horse because it was more about the idea of a horse. So because you've talked about merry-go-round horses before, this idea of how ridiculous life is that adults put kids on. You know, these fairground horses.
Yeah, there is something. Yeah, when we take distance to how, you know, we organize and live our lives, how we stage things. It's like, you know, I have four kids. I have three sons and a daughter. And when I took them to the mall to go and buy food or clothes, or there would always be like these children rides. And then you have like a tiny Disney-fied helicopter or a car, you know, that looks like as if it has a face. And of course, your kids go like, oh, daddy, can I sit in it? And then, you know, you lift your kid and put it in this kind of little Disney-like car. And you drop in a coin and then it starts to move back and forth. So it's just shaking your kid for 2 minutes. And I always thought, you know, if someone from Mars would look at me lifting my kid in like a fake little car and it just shakes back and forth, there's something totally silly and ridiculous about it. And this is, well, an example of how we stage amusement or how we stage feelings sometimes, how we mold and need and structure open space to deliver sort of instant emotions or possibilities for identification or all these humanization of what surrounds us, how we tame and structure everything. There is, of course, something extremely powerful and ethically problematic about it when we think of political regimes or when we think of the larger scale. But when it's about the small staging that we do, like our living room, for example, and how we choose a couch and a sofa and a table. And it's all cardboard scenery, yeah, given how short our lives are. So there is some silliness in it and also a beauty in the fact that it is silly. And these are things that I think a lot about. I'm not a person who considers life as something heavy or charged, or I would rather say that life is a tragicomic. I truly and profoundly love this idea of conceiving life as tragicomic. Yes, there is suffering, but there is also silliness and absurdity and and lightness. And so both are so important to have both sides combined.
This reminds me of that Albert Camus quote, which is, if we all know we're going to die, why don't we just kill ourselves? I mean, I always thought that was genius and very funny because it's the epitome of what we're talking about, maybe. But I don't want to end on that, though. So I want to ask you just about the themes in your work at present, if anything's shifted, or maybe it's the same as it was before the whole lockdown experience and this weirdness. But the themes you're thinking about or working through or working on at the minute in the work?
I don't really think that the lockdown here in Belgium had such an impact on what I try to articulate and work on as an artist, subject-wise. It is about the human condition. It's about our silliness. It is about the difficulties that we have to deal with. And I don't really see at this point that it really impacted the way that I produce work. Also, because I never really believed in art to be very, very close to the actuality. Of course, I love to include actuality. I made a whole project about a fictitious cruise liner boat, a project that was called the Sea of Tranquility, was the name of my big fat cruise liner. And it was about, you know, the fact that there is you need like 10,000 workers to make one ship. And it is a bit like Fritz Lang Metropolis, where you have the workers in the belly of the ship that are not allowed to go to the upper decks. So there's like a hierarchy on board of the ship. They have their own bars down there in the boat, and they can't go upstairs because there is, you know, the other people in that are higher in hierarchy. And so I talked about this idea of leisure and about social inequality and all that. So I'm, but then again, these are subjects of all times. So I do love to include actuality, but more like in a digested way.
Yeah.
And so, you know, like, remember when the Twin Towers came down in New York, you had a lot of painters painting the Twin Towers. But then, of course, it becomes more like a time document than that it remains like an art piece that is, you know, that still talks about more than the very event, the very tragic event that happened, or people that were making paintings at the time of George W. Bush. Like, kids don't know even now who he was, you know. Yeah. So when you're like very one-dimensionally and directly on the actuality, I don't believe it has a long life in the arts. So I believe you can absorb and include daily life references and actuality, but then more in a digested way. And in that sense, I would not now make work that is directly related to the quarantine or the or the virus.
No.
Subject-wise, I mean.
Yeah. No, I would agree with that. I mean, I wonder if the space, you know, because you said it was interesting to hear you say that it was quite numbing. So do you feel like you're rested? I mean, what have you come out of it feeling like in terms of energy or ideas or, you know, the break? Has it felt like you've been with family and then you're now back and this sense of excitement? What's it left you with in terms of maybe not thinking so much about what it was, but more like what the experience has been, this distance and then coming back to things?
I think by nature I've always been a person that took a step backward and tried to reflect on things with a reflective distance. While of course on other moments I can be fully absorbed by emotion, but I've always had this kind of pensive pondering modus as well. So it's not that the quarantine made me realize that something like that exists as well. So in that sense, I profoundly enjoyed the time I had with my kids to go for long walks, for which I normally don't have the time.
Yeah,
and they also don't have that, of course, because during the year they have to go to school, and so there was more time for bonding with my direct. With my kids and the family, so that to me was the most important, I would say. But generally spoken, when it comes to my work, it did not really deliver a sort of an input or a different view on things.
No.
So yeah,
I think that's brilliant, and what an amazing place to be that it doesn't shake you. You know, you don't feel threatened by it in that way, you know, that you feel that it does feel like you're very confident. I know you've said it, you've been faking it to make it for a while, but maybe you're not faking it anymore. Okay, brilliant. Well, I'm gonna end there and just say thank you so much. It's been brilliant to research the work and get more into it, and there's a lot of it. I encourage everyone to go to your website and the various galleries. Ron Mandos Gallery is the gallery where the animation show is currently on, the Unstilled Life show, of which your video Night is part of. And then you also have your own website. I'm just trying to find it. Can you give me your website?
Yeah, it's just hansopdebeek.com. So it's
hansopdebeek.com. Perfect.
Yeah, very simple.
Lovely. I'll say it right eventually.
You can watch all videos on there and all documentation on the installations and sculptures and watercolors and the theater and opera work that I've been doing. It's all there. So great. I'm very happy to invite.
Which we people. Didn't get into enough. I wish we'd got more into the. Maybe the next one can be in the opera. Looking forward to getting into it. Well, thank you so much.
Thank you so much for this conversation.
It was fantastic. And take care.
You too. Bye.
Ciao.